This ends Disc 6. The Master and Margarita, Disc 7.
After he had died, Koroliesov got up from the floor, shook the dust off his dress trousers, smiled a fake smile, and withdrew to lukewarm applause. The MC then began to speak. "We have just heard Sava Potapovich's remarkable performance of The Covetous Knight. That knight had high hopes that frolicsome nymphs would flock around him and that he would enjoy many similar delights. But as you can see, nothing of the sort came to pass. No nymphs flocked around him. The muses paid him no tribute. He did not erect any castles. On the contrary, he ended up in disgrace and died from a damned stroke while sitting on top of a chest full of foreign currency and precious stones. May this be a warning to you. Something similar will happen to you, maybe even worse, if you don't hand over your foreign currency." It is difficult to say whether it was Pushkin's poetry or the MC's prose that made the greatest impression, but suddenly a timid voice was heard in the audience. "I'll hand mine over." "By all means, please come up on stage," invited the MC, staring out at the dark auditorium. On stage there appeared a short, fair-haired fellow who, by the looks of him, hadn't shaved for about 3 weeks. "I'm sorry, what is your name?" queried the MC.
"Kanavkin Nikolai,"
answered the shy newcomer. "Ah, pleased to meet you, Citizen Kanavkin. And what would you like to tell us?"
"I'll hand mine over,"
was Kanavkin's timid reply. "How much?"
$1,000
and 20 gold 10-ruble coins. "Bravo! Is that all there is?" The man in charge of the program stared straight into Kanavkin's eyes, and in so doing seemed to be bombarding him with rays. The audience held its breath. "I believe you," exclaimed the actor at last, lowering his eyes. "I believe you. Those eyes aren't lying. After all, how many times have I told you that your biggest mistake is underestimating the significance of people's eyes? The tongue can conceal the truth, but the eyes never. You're asked an unexpected question. You don't even flinch. It takes just a second to get yourself under control. You know just what you have to say to hide the truth, and you speak very convincingly. And nothing in your face twitches to give you away. But the truth, alas, has been disturbed by the question, and it rises up from the depths of your soul to flicker in your eyes. And all is lost. The truth is detected, and you are caught." After delivering this very convincing speech, the actor cordially questioned Kanavkin. "So where is it hidden?"
"At Porokhovnikova's, my aunt's, and Pretistienka."
"Ah, that's... just a minute. That's Klavdia Ilinichna's place, is that right?"
"Yes."
"Ah, yes, 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 yes. A small private residence, with the gardens across the street? Well, of course, I know the place, I know it well." "And where did you put the money?"
"In the cellar, in an Anium candy box."
The actor clapped his hands. "Have you ever seen anything like it?" he cried out in exasperation. "Where it's certain to get moldy and rot. Can you imagine entrusting people like this with foreign currency, huh? By God, they're as innocent as children." Kanavkin himself realized that he had ruined things and was completely at fault, and he hung his tufted head. "Money," continued the actor, "should be kept in the state bank, in special moisture-free safe deposit boxes, and not in your auntie's cellar where the rats can get at it. Shame on you, Kanavkin. You're a grown man." Not having any hole to drop through, Kanavkin settled for fingering the hem of his jacket. "Well, all right, then," said the actor, in less harsh tones. "No point in rubbing it in." Then, suddenly, he added, "Oh, by the way, while we're at it, let's kill two birds with one stone. Doesn't your auntie have some foreign currency, too?" "Huh?" Kanavkin, who had not expected things to take such a turn, shuddered, and the theater fell silent. "Oh, Kanavkin," said the MC, in a mildly reproachful tone, "and I was just singing his praises, and he had to go and spoil everything. That was not smart, Konavkin. After what I just said about eyes, it's obvious your auntie has some foreign currency, too. So why go on torturing us for no reason?
She does have some, Konavkin shouted brashly.
Bravo, cried the MC. Bravo, roared the audience. When the roar subsided, the MC congratulated Konavkin, shook his hand, offered to have a car drive him home, and then ordered someone in the wings to pick up the aunt in the same car and invite her to attend a performance at the Women's Theater.
Oh, by the way, your aunt didn't say where she hid hers, did she? Inquired the MC as he kindly offered Konavkin a cigarette and a lighted match.
Konavkin lit up and managed a woebegone grin.
I believe you, I do, sighed the actor. That old skinflint wouldn't tell the devil where she put it, so why would she tell her nephew? Well, never mind. We'll try and arouse her finer feelings. Perhaps not all the strings in her usurious heart have rotted away. All the best, Konavkin. And a happy Konavkin departed. The actor then inquired if anyone else wanted to hand over any foreign currency, and he was answered by silence.
Peculiar birds, I swear, he said, shrugging his shoulders, and the curtains closed. The lights went out. It was dark for a while, and then a nervous tenor could be heard singing from afar.
There are piles of gold there, and they all belong to me.
Then came two bursts of muffled applause from somewhere. Somebody's handing over her money in the women's theater, burst out Nikanor Ivanovich's red-bearded neighbor. He heaved a sigh and added, Ah, if it weren't for my geese. You see, I keep some fighting geese out at Lianozovo. I'm afraid they'll die without me. A fighting bird is delicate and needs a lot of attention. Oh, if it weren't for my geese. Pushkin can't catch me off guard. And he heaved another sigh. At this point, bright lights came on in the hall, and Nikanor Ivanovich began to dream that cooks in white hats carrying ladles in their hands came streaming through all the doors into the theater. The cooks were dragging in a vat of soup and a tray filled with slices of black bread. The audience came to life. The merry cooks pushed through the rows of spectators, ladling the soup into bowls and doling out bread.
Eat up, guys, cried the cooks, and hand over your foreign currency. Why sit here for nothing? Who wants to eat this filthy gruel? Go home and have a real drink and some hors d'oeuvres and feel good.
Let's take you, Dad. What are you in for? Asked a fat, red-necked cook, addressing Nikanor Ivanovich and passing him a bowl of soup with one lone cabbage leaf floating on top.
I haven't got any! I haven't got any! Screamed Nikanor Ivanovich in a terrible voice. Can't you understand? I haven't got any!
You don't? Roared the cook in a threatening bass. You don't? He crooned tenderly like a woman.
You don't, you don't, he murmured soothingly as he metamorphosed into the nurse, Praskovya Fyodorovna. She was softly shaking Nikanor Ivanovich by the shoulder as he moaned in his sleep. Then the cooks melted away, and the theater with the curtains fell to pieces. Through his tears, Nikanor Ivanovich could make out his room in the clinic and two people in white coats. But they were nothing like the smarmy cooks who had dished out unwanted advice. They were doctors, and with them was Praskovya Fyodorovna, who was holding a gauze-covered dish with a syringe instead of a soup bowl.
But what's this for? Said Nikanor Ivanovich bitterly as they gave him the injection.
I don't have any. None. Let Pushkin hand over his foreign currency. I don't have any.
Of course you don't, said the kind-hearted Praskovya Fyodorovna soothingly, and no one can blame you for it. Nikanor Ivanovich felt better after the injection and then fell into a dreamless sleep. But thanks to his cries, his anxiety communicated itself first to room 120, where the patient woke up and started to look for his head, and then to room 118, where the unknown master became upset and started wringing his hands in anguish while gazing at the moon and recalling that bitter autumn night, the last in his life, and the strip of light coming from under the door to his basement, and her loosened hair. From room 118, anxiety spread along the balcony to Ivan, and he woke up and burst into tears.
but the doctor quickly calmed all his distraught and afflicted patients, and they began to doze off. Oblivion came to Ivan last of all, just as dawn was breaking over the river. After the medicine had filtered through his entire body, peace and calm engulfed him like a wave. His body felt lighter, and the warm breeze of sleep caressed his head. The last thing he heard before he fell asleep was the pre-dawn twittering of the birds in the wood. But they soon fell silent, and he began to dream that the sun was already sinking behind Bald Mountain, and the mountain was encircled by a double cordon. Chapter 16. The Execution. The sun was already sinking behind Bald Mountain, and the mountain was encircled by a double cordon. The cavalry Ayla that had crossed the procurator's path around noontime had set out at a trot, moving toward the city's Hebron gate. A path had already been cleared for it. The infantry of the Cappadocian cohort had pushed the crowds of people, camels, and mules over to the sides of the road, and the Ayla, raising white columns of dust skyward as it moved along, trotted out to the intersection of two roads, one heading south to Bethlehem, the other northwest to Jaffa. The Ayla took the northwest road. The same Cappadocians were deployed along the sides of the road, having been successful in their efforts to clear the various caravans hurrying to Yerushalayim for the holiday out of the way in a timely fashion. Crowds of pilgrims had left their striped tents, which were pitched temporarily on the grass, and were standing behind the Cappadocians. After traveling about a kilometer, the Ayla overtook the second cohort of the Lightning Legion, and after traveling another kilometer, the Ayla was the first to arrive at the foot of Bald Mountain. There, the men dismounted. The commander divided them into platoons, and they cordoned off the base of the small hill so that it was accessible only from the Jaffa Road. A short time later, the Ayla was joined by the second cohort, which set up another cordon higher up the mountain. The last to arrive was the century under the command of Mark Ratkiller. It advanced in two columns, one on either side of the road, and in the middle of the columns, escorted by the secret guard, came the cart carrying the three condemned prisoners. They wore white boards around their necks which said, in both Aramaic and Greek, outlaw and rebel. Behind their cart came other carts, loaded with freshly hewn cross-beamed posts, ropes, shovels, buckets, and axes. Riding in these carts were the six executioners. Following them on horseback were the centurion Mark, the head of the temple guard of Yerushalayim, and the man in the hood, with whom Pilate had had a brief exchange in the darkened room inside the palace. A column of soldiers brought up the rear of the procession, and it was followed by a crowd of about 2,000 curiosity seekers, unfazed by the hellish heat, and intent on attending an interesting spectacle. Joining them were the curious pilgrims, who were not deterred from tagging along at the tail of the procession. The column wound its way up Bald Mountain as the thin voices of the accompanying heralds shouted out the words spoken by Pilate at noontime. The Ayla allowed everyone to go up as far as the second cordon, but the second century permitted only those connected with the execution to ascend any higher. Then it maneuvered quickly to disperse the crowd around the entire hill, so that the crowd was contained by the cordon of infantry above and the cordon of cavalry below. Now the crowd could see the execution through the thin chain of foot soldiers. And so, more than 3 hours had passed since the procession had ascended the mountain, and the sun was already sinking over Bald Mountain, but the heat was still unbearable. The soldiers in both cordons were suffering from the heat, languishing from boredom, and cursing the three outlaws in their hearts, sincerely wishing them all a speedy death. The short commander of the Ayla, his forehead damp and his white tunic dark with sweat, stationed himself at the bottom of the hill near the open part of the ascent. He kept walking over to the leather bucket of the first platoon, scooping out handfuls of water, drinking, and then wetting down his turban. After getting a little relief from this, he would walk back and again begin pacing back and forth along the dusty road leading to the summit. His long sword knocked against his laced leather boot. The cavalry commander wanted to be a model of endurance for his men, but he took pity on them and allowed them to stand under the pyramid-shaped tents they had fashioned by sticking their lances into the ground and draping them with their white cloaks. These tents provided the Syrians some shelter from the merciless sun. The water buckets were emptied quickly, and the cavalrymen from the different platoons took turns going for water to the gully at the foot of the hill, where, in the infernal heat and sparse shade of some emaciated mulberry trees, a muddy stream lived out its remaining days. The grooms stood there with the now rested horses, and, worn down by boredom, were trying to stay inside the shifting shade. The soldiers' tedium and the curses they directed at the outlaws were understandable. The procurator's fears that the execution would provoke riots in the hated city of Yerushalayim had fortunately proved groundless. And, contrary to all expectations, when the execution entered its fourth hour, there was not one person left in between the double cordon formed by the infantry up above and the cavalry down below. The crowd had been scorched by the sun and driven back to Yerushalayim. All that was left beyond the line of the two Roman centuries were two dogs. No one knew who they belonged to and how they had ended up on the hill, but the heat had prostrated them as well, and they lay panting with their tongues out, oblivious to the green-backed lizards scurrying between the red-hot stones, the only creatures unafraid of the sun, and the prickly plants curling over the ground. No one had attempted to free the prisoners, either in Yerushalayim, which had been inundated with troops, or here on the cordoned-off hill. And the crowd had gone back to the city because there was really nothing interesting about this execution. And back in the city, preparations were already underway for the great feast of Passover, which would begin that evening. The Roman infantry in the second cordon was suffering more than the cavalry in the first. The only respite the centurion rat-killer allowed his men was to remove their helmets and replace them with wetted-down headbands. But he kept his soldiers standing, with their spears in their hands. Wearing the same kind of headband around his head, only dry, not wetted down, he paced back and forth not far from the group of executioners, without having removed the silver lions' heads from his tunic or his scabbard, sword or knife. The sun beat down on the centurion without causing him any distress, and it was impossible to look at the lions' heads on his tunic, so blinding was the glare of the silver which seemed to be boiling in the sun. Ratkiller's disfigured face showed no sign of exhaustion or discontent, and it seemed that the giant centurion had the strength to go on pacing like that all day and all night, and the next day as well, in short, for as long as he had to. To keep walking with his hands on his heavy bronze-studded belt, to gaze sternly now at the posts with the men being executed, now at the soldiers in the cordon, and to kick the toe of his shaggy boot indifferently at the bleached human bones or bits of flint that lay in his path. The man in the hood had settled himself on a three-legged stool not far from the posts and sat in placid immobility, only occasionally poking at the sand with a twig out of boredom. That there was not a single person behind the line of legionaries is not completely true. There was one man there, but he was simply not visible to everyone. The spot he had chosen was not on the side where there was an open ascent up the mountain and where the most comfortable view of the execution could be had, but on the northern side of the hill, where the ascent was not sloping and accessible, but uneven, with crevices and cracks, and where, in one of the crevices, clinging to the heaven-cursed waterless soil, trying to survive, was a sickly fig tree. It was precisely under this tree, which gave no shade at all, that this single spectator, who was not a participant in the execution, had ensconced himself, and he had been sitting there on a rock from the very beginning, that is, for more than 3 hours. Yes, The place he had chosen was the worst, rather than the best place to view the execution. Nevertheless, from that vantage point, the posts were visible, and visible as well beyond the cordon were the two shiny spots on the centurion's chest. And that was evidently more than sufficient for this man who obviously wanted to remain unobserved and undisturbed by anyone. 4 hours before, however, when the execution was just beginning, this man had acted very differently and had been very noticeable indeed. No doubt that was why he had changed his behavior and had sequestered himself. It was when the procession had passed the second cordon and reached the top of the hill that he had made his first appearance, acting like an obvious latecomer. Breathing heavily, he did not walk but ran up the hill, pushing others aside, and when he saw that the line had closed in front of him as well as everyone else, he acted as if he did not understand the angry shouts being directed at him and made a naive attempt to break through the cordon to the place of execution where the condemned men were already being taken off the cart. For his efforts, he received a heavy blow on the chest with the dull end of a spear, and he jumped back from the soldiers with a cry not of pain, but of despair. He gave the legionary who had struck him a dull and totally indifferent look as if he were impervious to physical pain. Coughing and gasping for breath, clutching his chest, he ran around the circumference of the hill, trying to find some break in the line on the northern side where he might be able to slip through. But it was too late. The ring had closed. And the man, his face contorted with grief, was forced to abandon his attempts to break through to the carts from which the posts had already been removed. Such attempts would only have led to his capture, and being arrested on that particular day was certainly not part of his plan. And so he had gone over to a crevice on the side of the hill where it was more peaceful and no one would bother him. This black-bearded man, his eyes suppurating from the sun and from lack of sleep, was now sitting on a rock, consumed with anguish. With a sigh, he would periodically open his tallit, once light blue, but now ragged and dirty gray from a life of wandering, and bare his chest, which had been bruised by the spear and was dirty with sweat. Then, in a state of unbearable torment, he would raise his eyes to the sky, following the flight of three vultures who, for some time now, had been tracing broad circles high in the sky in anticipation of the feast to come. Or he would fix his hopeless gaze on the yellow earth and see there the remains of a dog's skull with lizards running all over it. The man's suffering was so great that from time to time he would start talking to himself. "Oh, what a fool I am," he mumbled, swaying back and forth on his rock in a state of mental anguish, digging his nails into his swarthy chest. "Fool, stupid woman, coward, I'm carrion and not a man." He would fall silent, drop his head, and then, after taking a drink of warm water from his wooden flask, he would become animated again and grab for the knife hidden on his chest under his tallit or for the piece of parchment in front of him on the rock, beside a small stick and a bladder of ink. The parchment already had some scattered jottings. The minutes go by, and I, Levi Matvei, am here on Bald Mountain, and still death does not come. And further on, the sun is sinking, and still no death. Now, in a hopeless state, Levi Matvei had used his sharp stick to record the following. "God, why art thou angry at him? Send him death." When he had written that, he burst into tearless sobs and again dug his nails into his chest. The reason for Levi's despair was the terrible misfortune that had befallen Yeshua and himself, and also the mistake that he felt he, Levi, had made. 2 days before, Yeshua and Levi had been in Bethany outside Yerushalayim, where they had been visiting a vegetable gardener who had been most favorably impressed by Yeshua's preachings. Both guests had worked in the garden all morning, helping their host, and they were planning to go into Yerushalayim in the evening when it was cooler.
but for some reason Yeshua had suddenly started to hurry, said he had urgent business in the city, and left by himself around noontime. That had been Levi Matvei's first mistake. Why, oh why, had he let him go alone? In the evening, Matvei had not been able to go to Yerushalayim. He was hit by a sudden and terrible illness. He shook all over. His body was on fire, his teeth chattered, and he constantly had to ask for water. He was unfit to go anywhere. He collapsed on a horse blanket in the gardener's barn and lay there until dawn on Friday, when Levi's illness left him as suddenly as it had come. Although he was still weak and his legs trembled beneath him, he was tormented by forebodings of disaster. And so he said goodbye to his host and set out for Yerushalayim. There he learned that his forebodings had not deceived him. Disaster had taken place. Levi was in the crowd and heard the procurator pronounce the sentence. When the condemned men had been taken out to the mountain, Levi Matvei ran alongside the column in the crowd of curiosity seekers, trying at least to find some inconspicuous way to let Yeshua know that he, Levi, was there, that he would not forsake him on his final journey, and that he was praying that Yeshua would have a speedy death. But Yeshua had been looking up ahead to where they were taking him and had not seen Levi. And then, when the procession had gone a short distance, Matvei had a simple and ingenious idea as he was being jostled by the crowd pressing in upon the column. And, being as hot-headed as he was, he immediately cursed himself for not having thought of it sooner. The cordon of soldiers was not impenetrable. There were gaps in it. If one were quick and timed it right, it might be possible to bend down, slip between two of the legionaries, get to the cart and jump on it. Then Yeshua would be saved from suffering. A single instant would be enough to plunge a knife into Yeshua's back and shout, "Yeshua, I am saving you and I'm going with you. I, Matvei, your true and only disciple." And if God would grant him yet another instant of freedom, then he might be able to stab himself as well and avoid death on the post. But the latter was of little concern to Levi, the former collector of taxes. He did not care how he died. The only thing he wanted was for Yeshua, who had never done anyone any harm in his whole life, to escape being tortured. The plan was a very good one, but it had one flaw. Levi had no knife, nor did he have any money to buy one. Enraged at himself, Levi broke away from the crowd and ran back to the city. Only one thought burned in his fevered brain, and that was to get hold of a knife there right away, by whatever means, and then to catch up with the procession once again. He reached the city gates, maneuvering his way through the crush of caravans pouring into the city, and over to his left he saw the open door of a bread shop. Breathing heavily after his run down the blistering street, Levi regained control of himself and walked sedately into the shop. He greeted the woman behind the counter and asked for a loaf from the top of the shelf, saying it appealed to him more than the others. When the woman turned around to get it, he silently and quickly grabbed from the counter a long, razor-sharp bread knife, ideal for his purposes, and bolted out of the shop. A few minutes later, he was again on the Jaffa Road. But the procession was nowhere in sight. He started to run. Occasionally, he would have to fall down on the dusty road and lie still in order to catch his breath. And so he would lie, startling those passing by on mules and on foot en route to Yerushalayim. He lay listening to his heart pounding in his head, ears, and chest. After he had gotten some of his breath back, he jumped up and started running again, but at a slower and slower pace. When he could finally see the dust in the distance raised by the long procession, it had already reached the foot of the mountain. "Oh, God," groaned Levi as he realized that he would be late. And he did come too late. As the fourth hour of the execution was ending, Levi's suffering reached its peak, and he flew into a rage. He got up from his rock and threw away the knife, which, as it seemed to him now, he had stolen in vain. He stamped on his flask, thus depriving himself of water, tore the kafia off his head, clutched at his straggly hair, and began cursing himself. He cursed and yelled out meaningless words. He roared and spat, reviling his mother and father for bringing such a fool into the world.
seeing that his cursing and swearing had no effect and had caused no change in the blazing sun, he narrowed his eyes, clenched his dry fists, raised them up to the sky, to the sun that was creeping lower and lower as it lengthened the shadows and neared its fall into the Mediterranean Sea, and he demanded that God send a miracle right away. He demanded that God send death to Yeshua then and there. When he opened his eyes, he realized that everything on the hill had stayed the same, with the exception of the shiny spots on the centurion's chest, which had gotten dimmer. The sun's rays were falling on the backs of those being executed who were facing toward Yerushalayim. Then Levi cried out, "I curse you, God!" In a hoarse voice, he shouted that he had become convinced of God's injustice and no longer had any intention of believing in him. "You're deaf," bellowed Levi. "If you weren't deaf, you would have heard me and killed him on the spot." Narrowing his eyes, Levi waited for fire to fall from the sky and strike him down. That failed to happen, and without opening his eyelids, Levi went on shouting out caustic, offensive remarks to the sky. He screamed about his utter disenchantment and about the fact that there were other gods and religions. Yes, another god would never have allowed someone like Yeshua to be strung up on a post and burned by the sun. "I was mistaken," cried the now completely hoarse Levi. "You are the god of evil. Or has the smoke from the temple censers blinded your eyes? And are your ears deaf to everything but the trumpet calls of the priests? You are not an omnipotent god. You are a black god. I curse you, god of outlaws, their protector and their soul." At this point, something blew in the face of the former tax collector, and something stirred beneath his feet. There was another gust, and when Levi opened his eyes, he saw that everything around him had changed, either because of his curses or for some other reason. The sun had disappeared without reaching the sea it sank into every evening. After swallowing the sun, a menacing thundercloud was rising relentlessly on the western horizon. White foam bubbled around its edges, and its smoky black belly was fringed with yellow. The cloud rumbled from time to time and emitted streaks of fire. The wind that had suddenly blown up chased spirals of dust down the Jaffa Road, across the sparse valley of Gion, and over the pilgrims' tents. Levi fell silent and wondered whether the thunderstorm about to envelop Yerushalayim would have any effect on poor Yeshua's fate. And as he gazed at the streaks of fire that were splitting open the storm cloud, he begged for the lightning to strike Yeshua's post. Levi looked repentantly at the clear part of the sky not yet devoured by the storm cloud, where the vultures had flown in order to escape the thunder and lightning, and he thought that he had been much too hasty with his curses. Now God would not listen to him. Levi turned his gaze to the foot of the hill where the cavalry regiment was deployed, and saw that significant changes had taken place there. He had a good view from above and could see the soldiers bustling about, pulling their lances out of the ground and throwing on their capes, and the grooms running out to the road, leading raven black horses by the reins. It was obvious that the regiment was preparing to move out. Shielding his face from the blowing dust with his hand and spitting the sand out of his mouth, Levi tried to figure out the significance of the cavalry's imminent departure. When he turned his glance upward, he could make out a small figure in a crimson-colored military chlamys who was making his way up to the execution site. Sensing that the joyous end was at hand, the former tax collector felt a chill in his heart. The man ascending the mountain in the fifth hour of the outlaw's suffering was the commander of the cohort, who had ridden out from Yerushalayim along with his orderly. At a wave of Ratkeller's hand, the cordon of soldiers opened up, and the centurion saluted the tribune. The latter drew Ratkeller aside and whispered something to him. The centurion saluted a second time and moved over to the group of executioners who were sitting on rocks at the foot of the posts. The tribune walked over to the man sitting on the three-legged stool, and he got up politely to meet him. The tribune said something to him in a low voice, and they both walked over to the posts. They were joined by the chief of the temple guard. Ratkiller cast a squeamish glance at the dirty rags piled on the ground by the posts, rags that had once been the criminals' clothing and had been rejected by the executioners. He summoned two of them and ordered, "Follow me." A crazed, raspy-sounding song could be heard coming from the nearest post. On it was Gestas, who had been driven mad by the flies and the sun when the execution was nearing the end of its third hour, and who was now quietly singing something about grapes. He would, however, occasionally shake his turbaned head, and when he did, flies would lazily swirl off his face, only to return and light on it again. Dismas, who was on the second post, was suffering more than the other two because he had not lost consciousness. And he shook his head right and left frequently and systematically so that he could strike an ear against each shoulder. Yeshua had been more fortunate than the other two. In the first hour, he had had intermittent fainting spells, and then he lost consciousness. His head, in its straggly turban, hung on his chest, and he was therefore so covered with flies that his face had disappeared beneath a black, heaving mask. Fat horseflies clung to his groin, stomach, and armpits, sucking on his naked yellow body. In response to a sign made by the man in the hood, one of the executioners took a spear, and another brought a bucket and sponge over to the post. The one with the spear raised it and ran it along each of Yeshua's arms, which were stretched out along the crossbeam of the post and fastened to it with ropes. The body with its protruding ribs gave a shudder. The executioner ran the end of the spear over his stomach. Then Yeshua raised his head, and the flies took off with a buzzing sound, thus revealing the hanged man's face. Bloated from bites, and with swollen eyelids, his face was unrecognizable. Ungluing his eyelids, Hanotzri glanced down. His usually bright eyes were now dulled. "Hanotzri," said the executioner. Hanotzri's swollen lips moved slightly, and in a hoarse outlaw's voice he asked, "What do you want? Why have you come?" "Drink," said the executioner, lifting the water-soaked sponge to Yeshua's lips on the end of the spear. His eyes flashing with joy, Yeshua pressed his lips to the sponge and greedily drew in the moisture. Dismas's voice was heard from the neighboring post. "That's unfair. He's as much of an outlaw as I am." Dismas strained his body but could not move. His arms were tied to the crossbeam in three places with rings of rope. He pulled in his stomach, dug his nails into the ends of the crossbeam, and turned his head toward Yeshua's post. His eyes burned with malice. A cloud of dust enveloped the place of execution. It got very dark. When the dust lifted, the centurion shouted, "Silence on the second post!" Dismas fell silent. Yeshua pulled away from the sponge, and trying unsuccessfully to make his voice sound gentle and convincing, he hoarsely implored the executioner, "Give him a drink." It was getting darker and darker. The storm cloud rushing toward Yerushalayim already filled half the sky. Turbulent white clouds swept by in front of the thundercloud, which was bursting with black water and fire. Lightning flashed, and thunder clapped right above the hill. The executioner removed the sponge from the spear. "Praise the merciful hegemon," he whispered solemnly, and quietly pierced Yeshua through the heart. Yeshua shuddered, and whispered, "Hegemon." Blood ran down his stomach, his lower jaw trembled convulsively, and his head dropped down. As the thunder clapped a second time, the executioner let Dismas drink, and with the same words, "Praise the hegemon," killed him too. Gestas, who had lost his reason, cried out in fright as soon as the executioner appeared beside him, but when the sponge touched his lips, he growled something and took hold of it with his teeth. Seconds later, his body also hung limply, straining against the ropes. The man in the hood walked behind the executioner and the centurion, and behind him came the head of the temple guard. After stopping at the first post, the man in the hood looked closely at the bloodied Yeshua, touched the sole of his foot with his white hand, and said to his companions, "He's dead." The same ritual was repeated at the other posts. Following this, the tribune signaled to the centurion, turned around, and began walking down the hill together with the head of the temple guard and the man in the hood. Dusk had fallen, and lightning ripped through the black sky. Suddenly there was a burst of fire, and the centurion's shout, "Break ranks!" was drowned out by the thunder. The happy soldiers ran off down the hill, putting on their helmets. Darkness covered Yerushalayim. The sudden downpour hit the sentries as they were halfway down the hill. The water poured down so ferociously that churning streams nipped at the soldiers' heels as they ran down the hill. They slipped and fell on the wet clay as they hurried to reach the level road on which, barely visible through the veil of water, the cavalry, soaked to the bone, was heading back to Yerushalayim. A few minutes later, in the churning brew of thunder, fire, and water, there was only one man left on the hill. Brandishing the knife, which had not been stolen in vain, scaling the slippery ledges, grabbing hold of anything he could, crawling at times on his hands and knees, he headed straight for the posts. He would at times disappear in complete darkness, only then to be suddenly lit up by flickering light. When he reached the posts, standing ankle deep in water, he ripped off his heavy, soaked tallit, and wearing only his shirt, threw himself at Yeshua's feet. He cut the ropes around his shins, climbed up on the lower crossbeam, embraced Yeshua, and released his arms from their restraints. Yeshua's wet, naked body fell on top of Levi and knocked him to the ground. Levi was about to hoist him up on his shoulder, but something stopped him. He left the body in a pool of water on the ground, with its head thrown back and its arms flung out, and ran, slipping on the wet clay, over to the other posts. He cut the ropes on them, too, and the two bodies fell to the ground. Minutes later, all that was left on the top of the hill were those two bodies and three empty posts. The water beat down on the bodies and turned them over. By that time, both Levi and Yeshua's body had vanished from the top of the hill. Chapter 17. An upsetting day. On Friday morning, that is, the day after the accursed performance, the entire staff of the Variety Theater, the bookkeeper Vasily Stepanovich Lastochkin, two clerks, three typists, both cashiers, the messenger boys, ushers, and cleaning women, in short, everyone at the theater, were not at their posts. Instead, they were all sitting on the sills of the windows above Sadovaya Street, looking down at what was happening outside the theater. Stretched along the wall in a double line that reached as far as Kudrinsky Square were thousands of people. At the front of the line stood 20 or more of the most prominent scalpers in the Moscow theatrical world. The people in line were very agitated and kept attracting the attention of passers-by with their inflammatory stories of the previous day's extraordinary performance of black magic. These stories had particularly distressed the bookkeeper, Vasily Stepanovich, who had not attended the performance. The ushers were saying all sorts of preposterous things. For example, that after the performance, some ladies ran down the street indecently clad, and other things of that sort. The modest and quiet Vasily Stepanovich merely blinked his eyes as he listened to all their wondrous tales. He had no idea what he should do, even though something did have to be done, and by him in particular, since he was now first in command at the Variety Theater. By 10 in the morning, the line of ticket seekers had swelled to such proportions that the police had gotten wind of it. Mounted and on foot, they descended on the scene with astonishing speed and managed to restore some order. However, even an orderly line a mile long was a source of distraction and amazement for the people on Sadovaya Street. That was the situation outside the theater. And inside, things weren't going very well either. The phones in the offices of Likhodyeyev, Rinsky, and Varenucha, as well as those in the ticket office and the bookkeeping department, had been ringing non-stop since early morning. At first, Vasily Stepanovich had made some sort of response to callers, as had the cashier and the ushers, who mumbled something into the phone, but after a while, they stopped answering altogether because they had absolutely no answer to give to questions about the whereabouts of Likhodyeyev, Varenuha, or Rimsky. At first, they had tried to get off with lines like, "Likhodyeyev is in his apartment," but this only made the callers say that they had called there and been told that he was at the Variety. An agitated lady had called, demanding to speak with Rimsky. After she had been advised to call his wife, the receiver burst into tears, saying that she was his wife, and that Rimsky was nowhere to be found. It was the beginning of a kind of nonsensical farce. The cleaning woman had already told everyone that when she came to clean the financial director's office, she found the door wide open, the lights on, the window overlooking the garden smashed, the chair overturned on the floor, and no one there. Just after 10, Madame Rimsky charged into the Variety, wringing her hands and sobbing. Vasily Stepanovich was totally at a loss and had no idea what to advise her. Then at 10:30 the police showed up. Their first completely reasonable question was, "What's going on here, citizens? What's this all about?" The theater staff pushed a pale and flustered Vasily Stepanovich forward and then stepped back. He had no choice but to call a spade, and admit that the administration of the Variety Theater, to wit the director, financial director, and manager, had vanished, and their whereabouts were unknown, that after last night's performance, the MC had been removed to a psychiatric hospital, and that, briefly put, last night's show had been nothing short of scandalous. After consoling the sobbing Madame Rimsky as much as they could, and sending her home, they seemed most interested in the cleaning woman's account of the state of the financial director's office. The staff was asked to get back to work, and a short time later, an investigative unit arrived, accompanied by a muscular dog the color of cigarette ash, with highly intelligent eyes and pointed ears. The theater staff was immediately abuzz with the rumor that the dog was none other than the famous Ace of Diamonds. And it was, in fact, he. His behavior astounded everyone. As soon as Ace of Diamonds ran into the financial director's office, he started to growl and bared his monstrous yellow fangs. Then he lay down on his belly, his expression a blend of anguish and fury, and started to crawl over to the broken window. Having overcome his fear, he suddenly jumped up on the windowsill, stuck his pointed muzzle up in the air, and let out a wild and vicious howl. Not wanting to come down from the window, he growled and trembled and tried to jump out. The dog was led out of the office and let go in the lobby, and from there he went out the front entrance into the street, leading those who were following him over to the taxi stand. There, he lost the scent. After that, Ace of Diamonds was taken away. The investigative unit settled into Varenuha's office and began summoning one by one all members of the Variety staff who had witnessed everything that had gone on at yesterday's performance. It must be said that the investigators encountered unforeseen difficulties every step of the way. The thread kept breaking in their hands. Had there been any posters? Yes, there had. But during the night they had been pasted over with new ones. And now, for the life of them, they could not find a single one. And where had the magician come from? Who knows? Wouldn't there have been a contract?
One would assume so, replied a distraught Vasily Stepanovich.
And if there had been a contract, would it have gone through bookkeeping?
Absolutely, answered Vasily Stepanovich in distress.
So where is it?
It's not here, replied the bookkeeper, growing paler by the minute and spreading his hands helplessly. And indeed, there was no trace of any contract, not in bookkeeping's files, nor in those of the financial director, Likhodyeyev, or Varenuha.
And what was this magician's name?
Vasily Stepanovich didn't know. He hadn't been at the show.
The ushers didn't know. The ticket office cashier crinkled her brow and thought and thought and finally said,
Volant, I think.
And are you sure it was Volant?
Well, maybe not. Maybe it was Falant.
The Bureau of Foreigners had never heard of any magician named Volant or Falant. Karpov, the messenger boy, reported that he thought that the magician had been staying at Likhodyeyev's apartment.
Naturally, they went there right away, and no magician was to be found. Nor was Likhodyeyev. Grunya, the maid, wasn't there either, and no one knew where she had gone. Missing, too, was the chairman of the House Committee, Nikanor Ivanovich, and Prolyeznyov. Something utterly unimaginable had occurred. The entire administrative staff of the theatre had disappeared. A strange and scandalous performance had taken place yesterday, but who had staged it and at whose instigation was not known. And meanwhile, it was getting on toward noon, the time when the box office was supposed to open. Under the circumstances, however, that was out of the question. A huge piece of cardboard was hung on the doors of the theatre saying, "Today's performance cancelled." There was a commotion, starting at the head of the line, but once it was over, the line nevertheless began to break up, and in an hour, there was no trace of it left on Sadovaya Street. The team of investigators left to continue their work elsewhere, the theatre staff was dismissed, except for the watchman, and the doors of the Variety were locked. The bookkeeper, Vasily Stepanovich, still had two things to do right away. First, go to the Entertainment Commission to report on yesterday's events, and second, visit the Commission's finance office to turn over the proceeds from yesterday's performance, 21,711 rubles. The meticulous and efficient Vasily Stepanovich wrapped the money in a newspaper, tied it with twine, put it in his briefcase, and, knowing the procedure well, set off for the taxi stand rather than the bus or trolley stop. As soon as the drivers of three separate cabs spotted the prospective passenger heading toward them with a bulging briefcase, they all took off from under his nose, looking back at him, for some reason, with loathing. Dumbfounded, the bookkeeper stood stock still for some time, trying to figure out what it all meant. A few minutes passed, and an empty cab pulled up, but as soon as the driver took a look at the passenger, he made a face. "Are you free?" asked Vasily Stepanovich, coughing with surprise. "Show me your money," the cabbie replied angrily, without looking at him. Becoming more and more dumbfounded, the bookkeeper pressed the precious briefcase under his arm, removed a 10-ruble bill from his wallet, and showed it to the driver. "I won't take you," was his curt reply. "I beg your pardon," began the bookkeeper, but the cabbie interrupted him. "Do you have any threes?" The completely baffled bookkeeper took two threes out of his wallet and showed them to the driver. "Get in," he shouted, banging the meter so hard that he almost broke it. And off they went.
"Are you short on change?"
the bookkeeper asked timidly.
"I've got loads of change," roared the driver, his eyes bloodshot with rage, blazing in the rearview mirror. "This is the third time today, and others are having the same problem. Some son of a bitch gives me a 10-ruble bill, I give him change, 450. He's gone, the bastard. 5 minutes later, I look, and what have I got? A label from a bottle of mineral water instead of a 10-ruble bill."
Here the cabbie let loose some unprintable words.
"The next guy I pick up beyond Zubovskaya Street, another 10. I give him 3 rubles change. He walks off. I rummage in the change purse, and out flies a bee and stings me on the finger. A bastard!"
The cabbie again let go a stream of unprintable words.
"But the 10 is gone. Yesterday at the Variety..."
Unprintable words.
"Some sort of slimy magician did an act with 10-ruble bills."
Unprintable words. The bookkeeper was stunned. He shrunk back in his seat and acted as if he were hearing the word Variety for the first time. But meanwhile he thought, "Boy, oh boy." Having reached his destination, the bookkeeper paid the driver without any problem. He entered the building, and as he headed down the corridor to the director's office, he saw that he had come too late. The office of the Entertainment Commission was in chaos. A messenger girl ran past the bookkeeper with her eyes bulging and her kerchief askew.
"He's not there, not there, not there, my dears," she was screaming to no one knows whom. "His jacket and trousers are there, but there's nothing in the jacket."
She disappeared behind a door, and immediately afterwards sounds of breaking dishes were heard. The head of the first section, whom the bookkeeper knew, ran out of the secretary's room, but he was in such a state that he didn't recognize the bookkeeper and disappeared somewhere without a trace. Shaken by all this, the bookkeeper reached the secretary's room, which served as an anteroom to the chairman's office, and here he was utterly thunderstruck. A menacing voice could be heard coming through the closed door of the office, a voice that unmistakably belonged to Prokhor Petrovich, the chairman of the commission.
"Who is he raking over the coals now, I wonder?" thought the flustered bookkeeper.
And as he looked around, he saw something else that was unnerving. There, in a leather armchair, sobbing uncontrollably and clutching a wet handkerchief, her head thrown back and her legs stretched out into the middle of the room, was Prokhor Petrovich's personal secretary, the beautiful Anna Richardovna. She had lipstick all over her chin, and black streams of mascara ran down her eyelashes and over her peach-like cheeks. When she saw who had come in, Anna Richardovna jumped up and threw herself at the bookkeeper. Grabbing his lapels, she shook him and screamed, "Thank God, at least there's one brave soul. They all ran off. They all betrayed him. Come with me and see him. I don't know what to do." And still sobbing, she dragged the bookkeeper into the office. Once there, the first thing the bookkeeper did was drop his briefcase. Everything in his head went topsy-turvy. And it must be said, with good reason. Behind the huge desk, with its massive inkwell, sat an empty suit, moving a pen with no ink in it over a sheet of paper. The suit was wearing a tie and had a fountain pen sticking out of its breast pocket. But there was no neck and no head above the collar, nor were there any wrists poking out of the sleeves. The suit was hard at work and completely oblivious to the confusion raging all around. Hearing someone come in, the suit leaned back in its chair, and from above its collar came the voice of Prokhor Petrovich, so familiar to the bookkeeper.
"What is it? The sign on the door says that I'm not seeing anyone."
The beautiful secretary let out a shriek, wrung her hands and screamed,
"See, do you see? He isn't there. He's not. Bring him back. Bring him back."
Just then someone poked his head in the door, groaned, and then left. The bookkeeper felt his legs start to tremble and sat down on the edge of a chair. But he didn't forget to pick up his briefcase. Anna Richardovna kept jumping around him, grabbing at his suit and yelling, "I always tried to stop him when he used devil oaths, and now he's bedeviled himself." At this point, she ran over to the desk and, in a soft, musical voice that was slightly nasal-sounding from so much crying, she exclaimed,
"Prosha, where are you?"
"Who are you calling Prosha?" the suit asked haughtily, sinking deeper in the chair.
"He doesn't recognize me. He doesn't. Don't you see?" sobbed the secretary.
"Please don't sob in the office," said the irascible striped suit, already angry, extending its sleeve for a fresh stack of papers, obviously intending to attach memos to them.
"No, I can't look at this. No, I can't," cried Anna Richardovna, and ran out into the anteroom, followed, like a shot, by the bookkeeper. "Just imagine, I was sitting here," began Anna Richardovna, trembling with agitation, and once again grabbing the bookkeeper by his sleeve. "And in walks a cat, black, big as a hippopotamus. I naturally screamed, 'Scat!' He takes off, and a fat man with a kind of cat-like mug comes in instead. He says to me, 'Are you the one who screams, scat, to visitors?' And he goes right in to Prokhor Petrovich. Naturally, I follow him and yell, 'Have you gone crazy?' But the brazen fellow goes right up to Prokhor Petrovich and sits down in the chair opposite. Well, Prokhor Petrovich, he's the nicest man you'll ever meet, but he's high-strung. He just blew up. I don't deny it. He's irritable, works like a horse, and he blew up. 'How dare you,' he says, 'burst in unannounced.' And just imagine, that smart Alex sank back in his chair and said, smiling, 'But I've come,' he says, 'on a little matter of business. Prokhor Petrovich blew up again. 'I'm busy.' And the other one, can you believe it, says back, 'You're not busy with anything at all.' How do you like that?" Well, naturally, at that point, Prokhor Petrovich's patience ran out, and he shouted, 'What the hell is this? Get him out of here! The devil take me!' And then, just imagine, the other one flashes a grin and says, 'You want the devil to take you? That can be arranged.' And bang, before I can let out a scream, I see that the guy with the cat-like mug is gone, and sitting there is the suit. 'Oh,' howled Anna Richardovna, her mouth stretched so wide that it lost its shape." She choked back her sobs
and took a deep breath, but then she said something completely nonsensical.
"And it writes, writes, writes. Drives you crazy. Talks on the phone. A suit. Everyone's run off like scared rabbits."
The bookkeeper merely stood there shaking. But at that point, fate came to his rescue. Striding into the anteroom in a calm and businesslike way came the militia, that is, two policemen. When she saw them, the